Welcome to the Eyes on Conservation podcast, episode 192. For a full list of today's show notes, including web links and music selections, please head over to www.wildlensinc.org/EOC192. Real quick, I just want to take a moment to encourage you to please head over to patreon.com/wildlenscollective and make a donation to expand the work that we're doing here. As one of the longest running conservation podcasts out there, we are uniquely positioned to do some incredible work in the future, but it will require additional funding. So if you can manage even a buck a show, your donation will fuel that work, and it also comes with perks. Thank you so much for your contributions in advance. Today, we join Eyes on Conservation's Matthew Podolsky in an interview with John Casby, director of the documentary When Lions Become Lambs, winner of the Tribeca Film Festival's Best Editing Award in the documentary competition.
The last decade or so has seen catastrophic destruction of the African elephant. New generation of poachers threatens to exterminate him. The time has come when we must take a stand. To all the poachers, to all the buyers, your days are numbered.
Casby spent much of his 20s in Kenya, chronicling the lives and hardships of not only the rangers protecting endangered elephants in the region, but also the difficult decisions poachers make to support their families. Casby tells their stories with disciplined impartiality. However, viewers may struggle to remain emotionally unwavering as you're really dropped into the shoes of a community bursting with complexities, each doing what it must to survive.
Well, the first thing I'm going to have you do is I'm just going to have you introduce yourself. Tell me your name and a little bit about who you are.
Yeah, my name is John Casby. I'm the director of When Lambs Become Lions, and I've been working on, you know, documentary films from a pretty young age. My parents were Christian missionaries, and so I kind of grew up in this environment where the first, you know, 13 to 14 years of my life was kind of traveling around the world. You know, spent a lot of time in Kenya, Serbia, India, and Australia, you know, doing that type of religious work, and then have shifted quite a bit and now work in documentary. But there's quite a few parallels between the two lifestyles. So in a lot of ways, I feel like I was kind of raised in this environment that made transitioning to documentary filmmaking make a lot of sense.
Wow, super fascinating. Tell me, I mean, I wonder if you can just give us a very sort of brief overview of what your film is about.
Yeah, When Lambs Become Lions is about two men on either side of the ivory trade. So one is an ivory dealer and the other is a wildlife ranger, and they are cousins. So, you know, that was a small detail, but something that had huge implications. And it was something we realized about 8 months into the process, the relationship between these two men. And it was the moment when I realized that this is not a short film and that this could actually be something longer. And I just think it really speaks to the complexity of the situation on the ground.
It certainly does, and the film is amazing. But before we dive into some of the more detailed questions I have for you about the project, I feel like we should upfront talk about what opportunities listeners might have to see the film.
Yeah, for sure. So it's premiering in New York City this weekend at Village East Cinema, and I'll be doing Q&As as well. And then it'll be continuing in New York for a week, and it's also playing in Los Angeles right now at the Lemley Theater. And then we're expanding to a bunch of other cities over the coming weeks. And then, you know, in 2020, it'll be available on VOD.
Excellent. So, is there like a website where folks can sort of check to see if it's coming to a theater in their area?
Yeah, so the website is onelams.com, and we're also on all the social medias. So that's the best way to stay updated.
So tell me what your entry point into this story was.
Yeah, good question. So I'd done other short films in Kenya before this, three of them, and it was through those projects that I had relationships with people that, you know, relationships with Kenyans on the ground who were telling me that there had been so many filmmakers and journalists that had come to Kenya and kind of done stories around poaching, but that they hadn't seen anything that actually looked at it from the perspective of the poachers, and that they kind of felt like that was this missing piece, like it was an oversaturated space. X, who was an ivory dealer, they're like, just come meet him, you know, you'll like him. First hour of sitting down with him, he kind of found a way to flip all my preconceived notions around the issue on their head, and I was blown away. I mean, I kind of went into the situation with him thinking, I think what a lot of people think about when they think about it, which is that, you know, poaching is bad and the people that do it are making, you know, bad choices. And the explained to me early on is that there isn't actual separation between these two sides. They see themselves as one community that is kind of forced into one side or the other. But in reality, they're all still friends. They grew up together. And there's a lot of crossover between the two sides. And when he started explaining that to me, it started to click in that like, this is way more complex than the way I think we sometimes funnel these stories through media into these very like good versus evil Hollywood narratives. And, you know, he was saying things to me like, you know, we're out there killing elephants, but my father was killed when I was a child. You know, he was shot in the head 10 times and there were no repercussions. It was just swept under the rug. And yeah, you know, he was very direct too. He was very honest. He was like making eye contact. I kind of thought he would be a little bit secretive or shady and opaque, but he wasn't at all. I found myself like laughing with him. I found myself being charmed by this guy, and that was not what I expected to happen. And I kind of left the interaction thinking about him a lot and wanting to spend more time with him and wanting to see more of the choices he made and to understand his logic behind them.
This character X is the first person that we meet, and it's this like introduction to his community, and he's kind of walking around, and I mean, you know, right from the beginning that he's supposed to be a bad guy, but he's so compelling.
Yeah we really like, we fell for him. This project was made possible because of the relationship that we formed, you know, and it was about 7-8 months of just living with them, spending time together without really shooting. And it was like that time of building a foundation of friendship where it was like, we'd live together, we'd eat together, we would like ask each other questions. He got to know me just as well as I got to know him. He started to understand my motivations for wanting to be there and why I thought this film had value and why people need to see what was actually going on. And that kind of became what made the whole thing possible, because I think without that, especially when you're filming people doing illegal things and in sensitive situations and really taking huge risks to be a part of a project, there needs to be that foundation for it to work.
Yeah, that's and I mean, it's really cool. It's really interesting to hear you say that, because I mean, watching this film, and you know, as I mentioned, like I have experience working as a filmmaker in communities that are experiencing, you know, somewhat, you know, a comparable sort of situation where there is this sort of economic push for community members to get involved in an illegal wildlife trade, right? So I have this understanding of like the difficulty associated with like getting that sort of insider perspective and gaining that trust. And so I mean, there were numerous moments watching your film where I was just blown away by the level of access that you had and how clearly comfortable your characters were with your presence there. You spent 8 months with this character X before you even started shooting, you said?
Yeah. And I don't mean 8 months like living with him the whole time. A lot of that I was there with him, but it would also, you know, I'd come back home and take a week off here and there. Sure. And rest, things like that. But yeah, I mean, we talked a lot. We talked a lot over that first year, and very little of it involved a camera. And, you know, one thing that I think people, you know, people watch the film and they sometimes have that reaction of like, how in the world did you get a camera into these situations? And what happened was like, there's nothing in the film that takes place that I didn't already experience with them without a camera.
Right.
And like going on hunts with them without a camera, watching Hassan and his wife get into fights without a camera, seeing them interact with their kids, seeing like those really, you know, difficult, tender moments without a camera made it normal for me to be there. And so when I was there with a camera, it wasn't like this was new. it wasn't new content. It wasn't a new experience. It was something I'd already been a part of. And so they were much more, and it got peace with me filming it.
Sure. Sure. And so, what was the time period, you know, how long were you actually, shooting, you know, the time window that we see play out in the film?
I would go for 3 to 6 months at a time. And then I'd, you know, take a little bit of a break here and there and dump footage back in New York. And that went on for about 3.5 years. And then we did about a year of editing. And during that year of editing, I would go back every now and then for like pickups or when something, you know, new was unfolding. Yeah.
Gotcha.
But it was sporadic in ways, but also like I didn't do anything else. You know, I wasn't working on anything else when I did this. In a lot of ways, the film started to become an excuse to be there. You know, I really became close, not just with the characters in the film, but also the community around them. And enjoyed being there. Like, I really enjoyed living there with them. And so the film, in a lot of ways, kind of became a way to continue doing that. And but it was important. I mean, it was the foundation. Like, I don't think we would have gotten the types of moments we did if that wasn't underneath it all.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you worry. I mean, this is a conversation that I think when you're following a character like this character X in your film, right, who you feel for him, you know, you start to understand that, you know, this is somebody who's maybe doing things that we think are bad, but that we don't necessarily see him as a bad person, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you still see him doing these bad things, right? These things that, like, well, you know, I mean, regardless of like what, you know, sort of society, you know, I don't know, the sort of attitude that society has towards people that are doing this type of thing, that are poaching elephants. I guess my question is like, what was it like to be there with this group of poachers, like seeking to kill elephants?
It was really hard. I mean, like, you know, I went on 10 hunts total. The first 3 hunts I went on with them, they didn't let me bring a camera. And so I'm like, you know, watching them plan this, watching them go through and do this like devastating act. And, you know, when you have a camera, in a lot of ways, it can kind of separate you from the reality of what's going on. You have a heightened sense of purpose in being there and documenting it and saving it for other people to see. But when that's stripped, you're just a part of it. And it was, I mean, I had to take time off, you know, I had to take time and step away because I just got to a place where I was having a hard time relating to them, understanding them, and having a hard time loving them at certain points after some of these hunts. But eventually I got to a point where, you know, I eventually, by the end of it, was like having a deeper understanding as to why they were doing this. And I got to see the consequences of what happened when they didn't succeed. And for them, it was like they weren't feeding their kids. And started to recognize, like, they're waking up and going to sleep every day thinking about, how am I going to feed my kids? So when that is your first thought in the morning, you don't really have time to get to thinking about ethics. Like, there's privilege in having the opportunity to think about ethics and what is right and wrong and getting to that kind of dimension. So I don't know if that answers your question, but it ebbed and flowed. I mean, there were times where I was like fascinated by what they were doing and wanted to understand it more. There were times where I was disgusted by what they were doing and I just wanted to be away from them. I needed space. But I think at the core, like, there was a real friendship there. We really cared about each other, and we still do. And, you know, I spent more time with them than I did with anyone else, you know, during my mid-20s. They're forever a part of my life.
Eyes on conservation! Assemble!
We want to hear from you. We make these shows because we're passionate about the subject matter. We care about what happens to these animals. We care about what happens to these ecosystems, what happens to the planet, and each other too. But we know that you do too. We also make these shows because of you. The Eyes on Conservation podcast truly is about connecting all of us.
I think he's talking to you.
So the next time you hear something that makes you laugh out loud, or makes you cry, has you question the world a little bit, or just makes you go, let us know. We want to include your voice and your thoughts on future episodes. Here's how. Take out your smartphone and open the recording app on it. On an iPhone, it's called Voice Memos. On an Android, you can download Smart Voice Recorder or something similar. Hit the record button and hold the phone just like you would if you were talking to us on the other end. Or hold it about 4 inches from your face. Just don't get too close to the mic. You'll know it's recording because the waveform will start to dance around and the timer will start a ticking. Here's the good part. Tell us whatever you want to tell us. Tell us who you are, what you do all day, what your story is. The point is, we want to hear you. When you hit stop, Save the file with something descriptive, like your name and the date. Then open that file right there on the same app and look for a little square with an arrow poking out the top. This is how you share the file. From there, you can select the email app on your device, and if there is something specific you want to talk to us about, just jot a little note down for us. Then email it to info@wildlensinc.org. Boom, it's that easy. Oh, look, here comes one now.
Oh my goodness, that Gregory Haddock is just the most charming young man I ever heard.
Aw, shucks. Thank you, kind lady. We hope to hear from you soon.
As you said, right, lots of documentary films have been made about this issue. It's gotten a ton of media coverage over the last decade or so. It's the first time I've watched a film and feel like I really understood what it's like to be there.
That was the goal. You know, it felt like that was the piece that was missing. There's been so many docs that are like holistic around the whole issue, and a lot of docs that give you a ton of information and facts and that kind of thing. But there wasn't, like, what we felt was missing was an experiential piece that showed you the perspective that was kind of being labeled and categorized and like kept in this corner. What we're finding is that like the people that were being put in that corner did not feel separate from everyone else. You know, they felt very much so connected to the Rangers, very much so human. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, so, you know, and one of the other aspects of this and, you know, doing what you were doing is the risk, right? I mean, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about like the risk associated with this, because I mean, there's a lot of discussion about, I mean, people getting shot on both sides, both poachers and, you know, Rangers getting shot. And I mean, you said you went out on 10 hunts with this group of poachers. You know, what was it like sort of assessing that risk and like deciding that this was something that was worth it for you to do?
Yeah, I mean, the risk kind of came after the relationship. So like once we were close, it was clear that like this was something that needed to be done. One, I think in part to show people what's actually going on and what it's like. But two, you know, the characters are taking a huge risk by being a part of this project. It like felt it felt like necessary for me to take similar risk to be with them and to like live the way they do and to like, you know, go through these choices with them. And once I already cared about them, once they were a part of my life, like it felt natural in a lot of ways. Like it felt natural to take on, to like, you know, sleep in the same place, eat the same type of food, spend your time in the same way. And then when they make like risky choices, like being there for it, you know, being a part of those days. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, it was a lot harder at the beginning than it was at the end. You know, at the beginning, I was still kind of figuring out how it all worked and figuring out what the consequences would be like and figuring out how they get out of those tricky situations. By the end, it was like, I felt like I had my footing, understood what they were doing, and also understood why. Like I understood their motivations in a much deeper way. Not to say that justifies what they're doing, but I did have a sense of like, I know what's going to happen if they don't succeed here. And also like, I think when people hear poaching, they think of like, you know, men with machine guns taking down like 60 elephants. Like that's not what these guys are doing. These guys are killing 1 to 2 a year, and they're also very specific in the types they take down. You know, like they're not killing mothers that have kids. They're looking for like old males that are going to die in the next 2 to 3 years. And the process of killing is like an art form to them. You know, this is a skill that's been passed down from generation to generation through the fathers. And Lucas will spend weeks, you know, creating the specific type of poison for the elephant. And then it's more weeks actually finding the elephants, paying off everyone in between them and the elephants. And then once they actually hit it with an arrow, you're looking at 8 to 12 hours of tracking, waiting for the poison to spread and for the elephant to fall. And at every step, like it's extremely dangerous. Like if the wind is going behind them towards the elephant, it's over. The elephant will smell them and attack. So they're constantly checking the direction of the wind to make sure that they are behind the elephant and that the wind is coming from the elephant's direction so the elephant does not smell them. So yeah, as I kind of got deeper into it and realized just like how specific and how careful and how like precise what they're doing is, it shifted for me a little bit, you know. Not to say that it made it okay, or not to say that I was ever in support of it. Like it was always painful to see, and it was always an awful occurrence. But I also understood that, like, you know, the kids weren't going to eat if they didn't succeed. That there were hospital bills that weren't going to get paid.
Yeah,
it's starting to make sense, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Totally, man. And it's, you know, there's an sort of an undercurrent of this, I feel like in your film, maybe. But I think this is also like a much bigger picture issue throughout many countries in Africa, right? Where it's like there is this sort of like Western pressure to like preserve, you know, these shrinking populations, large mammal species on the African continent. And, you know, the blame is put sort of locally, or even if it's not, sort of regardless of like where the blame is placed, it's like, I feel like it's easy for us here in the US to forget about the fact that us living here in the United States, like we have a right to hunt. Like you or I could go out and buy a hunting license and go legally hunt an animal.
Right.
And, you know, just hearing you explain sort of the process involved in going out and hunting one of these elephants and how it is a tradition. And there is this, you know, process that has been handed down through generations of how to, you know, concoct this poison. It feels like that's a part of it, right? Like the tradition and this idea that, like, you know, generations ago, like this used to be something that was a part of their culture.
For sure. I mean, a lot of these men saw poaching become illegal in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. Like, poaching was made illegal, I think, 46 years ago. And so for a lot of their fathers, like, this was a way of life. This was, like, mm-hmm. a skill that was passed on. This is how they survived. And now, you kind of, when you step back and look at it, it's like, outsiders have come in and started taking steps to protect the land and protect the animals. And it gets really complicated when you start realizing that in some situations, they're allowing other outsiders to come in and pay huge amounts of money to kill these animals. But then when locals do it, they get killed. And they're aware of that. You know, like these guys are aware of that dynamic. And I think, you know, it's really complicated. It's really complicated when you start getting into like looking at who's coming from where and when money gets involved and power. It seems like there's a lot of corruption that starts to surface quickly.
Yeah. And you know, and again, it's like we're in your film, we're sort of experiencing this entirely through the eyes of these two main characters in your film. So, I mean, watching the film, you know, you don't really know for sure, like, is this corruption or is it not? And, you know, I'm thinking about the issue of payment for the poachers, right? Is like this very significant issue throughout the film. You know, this particular team of poachers that, you know, your one character is a part of, they're not getting paid and they're being told, you know, like, essentially, like, we don't know where the money is, we don't know what's going on, but you just have to keep waiting and eventually maybe you'll get paid. Yeah. it's just like baffling because it's like, you know, these people are being asked to risk their lives on a daily basis and they're not getting a paycheck.
Yeah, it was one of the most, it was really hard to see that and to see it happen so many times. And it's not just that they're not getting paid. I mean, like these guys, that ranger unit, like a lot of them had guns that didn't work. A lot of them are wearing sandals. They're underfed, you know, for 2 years, they didn't have access to a car, to a truck when they were out there. And so like they're on foot, you know, they're patrolling on foot, long hours. They're out there 28 days out of the month. They're not seeing their families really at all. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous. I want to say that like 1 to 2 rangers were killed each year I was there. And so eventually it started feeling like death was the only outcome for them. And there's also, like, I oftentimes felt more in danger with the rangers than I did with the poachers. You know, the rangers get calls at 3 a.m. pulling them into situations where there's live gun battles happening and they have no idea what's going on. They're all using the flashlights that are on their cell phones to like see what's happening. And it's extremely dangerous. And it feels like they're not equipped for success. And it's interesting because when I was finishing this project, I was like, how do I make sense of this? Like what? Like I didn't come out of it with any clear solutions to solve it. The only thing I really felt strongly about was that like the solutions are going to come from within. It's not going to be outsiders stepping into a Kenyan issue trying to solve it because we've seen that happen a lot and it hasn't been super successful. But when I would ask poachers and rangers, like, what do you want people to know? Like, what do you think would help the situation? Both sides agreed. If rangers were treated better and paid better, poaching would happen less. I can't tell you the number of poachers that were like, it's so easy because whenever we see a ranger, we can know we can pay them off because we know they're under-resourced. We know they don't have enough money. And we know that they're like trying to take bribes. And it feels like the system is just set up for corruption.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, it's like we're viewing this through the eyes of these characters, but with the Ranger unit, did you gain any insight into like what was going on big picture?
Yeah. So that was something that like the Rangers would actually ask me at times. They'd be like, can you go to our bosses and try to figure out like what's going on? And can you like speak on our behalf and stuff? And I was very much so not open to doing that while I'm making the film. We're keeping it in a contained perspective for the guys on the ground. Like that is the piece in the conversation we feel like is missing. And their confusion, you know, their uncertainty around what was going on was something I wanted audiences to feel. I wanted audiences to feel that frustration that they were feeling and not being paid. But then once I finished the film, I took it to their bosses and I showed them what we had made. And I asked them, I was like, what is going on? Like why are these guys not being paid? And I was really disappointed to hear them say, they're not filling out the paperwork correctly.
Oh my God.
And I was just like, are you like, I was literally like, I just spent 3 years with this group and I watched them do the paperwork correctly. Like, how can you lie to me about like, you know? And it was just like, I feel like I was being gaslit. So I don't know. I'm pretty frustrated and disappointed to say, I do not know.
Wow. So, I mean, you said you've taken this film and showed it to, I mean, these guys' bosses. Like how high up in the government are there plans to kind of, you know, screen this for government officials to try to like show people like what's going on at that level?
Yeah, we're working right now on figuring out the local impact strategy. It's interesting. I'm like really dying to go back to Kenya and to do like screenings of this with Ranger units and then do kind of like underground screenings with poacher communities. On one hand, but on the other hand, I know the reaction is going to be they're going to be kind of bored. They're going to be like, this is so boring and normal. Like, why are you showing us like, what?
Right. Like, this is just our normal everyday life. Like, why would somebody else care about this?
Right. Right. There's nothing new here. Like, this is like, you know, par for the course, but I do think that there's a conversation that could be had. And I actually think like having talks and community events with this film, with leaders in the industry and people that are like raising funding for these kind of things. Like, I think that it could have a huge impact. Cause at the end of the day, like we're not like, this is an experiential, emotional experience. This isn't a context information based film. And what I hoped we would do with it was help people realize that there's a big middle gray space to this whole situation that's being overlooked and it's being left out of the conversation. I think it's vital to kind of like acknowledge that and let it be a part of it, because on the surface this is about animals, but underneath, like, it's really about humans and it's really about the way we treat humans. And right now I don't think the way we're treating humans is leading us to a place where we're going to save the species.
I'll give kind of a spoiler alert for before this question. One of the things that, you know, you mentioned early on that, you know, these two main characters that you're following in the film, you know, one of them starts off on the poaching side and the other one starts off as a ranger. And, you know, I feel like as the film progresses and definitely, like, I mean, there's this moment and you explained that you initially didn't realize that they were cousins. It's the same at the beginning of the film. You don't know they're cousins, and then you see them interact for the first time and it's revealed that they're cousins, and it is this sort of aha moment in the film. And like it also opens up this opportunity for the character who is the ranger to provide information to his cousin who is a poacher. And you don't see like it, you don't see that happen right away, but you know that there's this, you know, economic, you know, strong economic incentive for that information to be shared. And you're just kind of waiting to like see what happens. I guess I'm just curious, like what that was like from your perspective, because you obviously had this moment while you were shooting on the film where you realized that these two characters were related. Like, what was that like?
I was in shock. I mean, the fact that X waited 8 months to tell me that, I think says a lot.
Right.
Because when it came out, I was like, how did you not mention this earlier? And he was like, why would I? That's like so normal. You know,
right.
Like their situation is not unique. Like there are many other people who have cousins, brothers, fathers and sons who are on either side of this issue. And so for him, he was like, yeah, like, why is this such a big deal? And that made me realize like, it's not a big deal. It's actually like common. And it kind of ties into that idea I was saying earlier. It's like, this is a community. This is a community that grew up together. Everyone knows each other. There are no secrets. There are no secrets. Everyone knows everything that's going on. And on the surface, you know, I think people play roles. Like when rangers see someone poaching and their boss is there, they'll do what they need to do to keep their jobs. But when they have an opportunity to take a bribe and feed their kids versus kill someone that they know or are friends with or are related to, they're going to take it. Mm-hmm. And I got to a point where I started to understand that. Like, that made sense to me. And I started realizing, like, if I was in their shoes, I don't know that I would be doing anything different. And once that moment happened, once I started feeling that way, it kind of became about how do we edit this so that audiences can go through that experience? Because for us, that was eye-opening. You know, that was like, I didn't think I'd get to a place where I was able to, like, understand some of these choices on the surface are so devastating and so, you know, morally wrong. But eventually started to kind of come around to see it from their perspective. And, you know, in the edit, we were using films like Heat. We were using the show Breaking Bad. Like, these were kind of our references for structure and for character development over time. Like, seeing someone that on the surface makes choices you don't agree with, but underneath is someone you still care about deeply and want to be with. You want to see them make their choices. You want to see the ripple effects of them. And that was just something we felt so strongly with both X and Asan.
Absolutely. I mean, you definitely feel that as a viewer. I mean, the relationship between these two cousins is so compelling, and you're just like, I mean, you're really on the edge of your seat, like waiting to see like what's going to happen next and how they're going to deal with these situations. And I mean, I guess, you know, my next question is, you know, is about the way you chose to end your film, which is just so like, I don't know how to feel about it, right? But it's it's surprising, right? Because I mean, you talk about this, you know, this sort of like revolving door between the poachers and the rangers, and how everybody knows each other, and people are going back and forth. You know, you learn that, you know, Asan, the character who is, you know, starts off as the ranger, you learn that he used to be a poacher, but then to see, you know, X at the end, like, give up poaching and, you know, to see him training to become a ranger was quite a surprise to me. And like, just the juxtaposition between like that moment and him like resigning to do this thing, you know, comparing that to like your opening scene where he declares that he's the king, right? Mm-hmm. Is just, it's unbelievable. Right. I don't know. I mean, what, like, did when that happened, like, did you know you had the ending to your film?
So let me tell you a story. So we finished the film, like, you know, I think it was late 2017, like December 2017. And X had not become a ranger at this point. So we'd finished the film, we color corrected, we did the sound mix, we'd done the conform, and we're preparing to premiere it in New York City in April. And I want to say it was about 3 weeks before that premiere, I got a call from X and he said, "Hey, I'm becoming a ranger." And I said, "Bullshit." And I hung up. I literally hung up on him. I was like, don't mess with me. Like, don't mess with me. And I just hung up. And the next day he calls me back and he's like, "Training starts in 3 days, just so you know. Like, are you coming or what?" And I was like, "Are you serious? Like, you're actually doing this?" Like, I was like, "Why the heck are you doing this?" And he's like, "Well, I can't poach anymore. And my uncle got me this job, or he got me this opportunity where I can train. If I pass training, I can become an informant. And they're going to pay me twice as much as Asan's getting paid." And it all clicked. I was like, aha, I see. Wow. You're not required to be out there 28 days out of the month. So it started making sense. And I rushed over to Kenya, filmed it, was like editing in the field, you know, sending footage online back to the editors in New York and scrambling to try to get it all in place before we screened it. And honestly, like, I didn't have time to think, like, I mean, in my mind, it was like, it's done, you know, like, there's just nothing left that can happen. And it also really, like, that choice he made at the end really brought it all full circle for me. That was like, it was like, he's now shown us just like the thin line between these two sides and how the side you're on doesn't actually mean that much. When at the end of the day, you're in this situation and you're feeling like, so you feel so few options in your ways in which you can survive. But yeah, I mean, I honestly, I didn't have a lot of time to think at that point. It was just like, get this in the film, play it through and hope that it all makes sense.
So you mentioned that you're, you know, looking forward to going back there and, you know, screening the film both for ranger units and potentially for poachers as well. I mean, let me ask this. I assume that you know, your two main characters have seen this film at this point?
Oh, yeah, many times.
Yeah.
So the main characters, I showed them the film before we even finished it. It was really important to me that they had a chance to watch it and that could, you know, give feedback. Because, in a, you know, part of the access in this was, like, I told them early on, like, I want to be there for everything, but if you ever want me to stop filming, you can tell me and I'll stop. Or if we ever film something that you're not comfortable with, you can tell me and we will delete it. And so that in the first, you know, 2 years of production, first year and a half of production, I would sit with them and delete footage that they didn't want existing. They didn't want people to see.
Wow.
But then by the end, the last year and a half, like, there was none of that. In the end, it was like they had fully, you know, they were fully in trust of what we were doing and they really wanted people to see everything. So, I mean, they went through the whole spectrum. You know, they like laughed, they cried, they were happy, they were angry. Like, it had, I mean, it's a surreal experience to watch 3.5 years of your life get boiled down to minutes. So it was very emotional, very intense, but you know, they're very proud. They're very, very proud of what we made together. And they believe that people should see it. And it was amazing because when we took this film to the Zurich Film Festival, and that festival actually flew X and Asan to the festival.
Wow.
For Q&As. And that was their first time leaving Kenya, first time on a plane, first time going to a movie theater, and it was to see their own film. And it was just surreal seeing them do Q&As, because it's one thing for me to talk about it, you know, as an outsider kind of coming in and having experience, but for them to talk about it for themselves is just like so powerful, so powerful. And I wish we could do more of that, honestly. So yeah, I mean, they love it. They love the film, and they think it's important. So
is there a concern, like, for their safety, you know?
Yeah, there was at the beginning. At the beginning, I was really concerned about that. And that was something we had a lot of conversations with them about, like, how do we do this without, you know, jeopardizing your safety or putting you in any type of legal risk? So I consulted with lawyers in Kenya and in the States and showed them the film multiple times and asked them for feedback. And we together kind of figured out the lines that we could push and the ones that we couldn't. And so from a legal standpoint, like, no one in Kenya could watch this film and use it as evidence in a case. If someone wanted to go after them, they'd have to create their own evidence. So from a legal standpoint, we feel good, and we've kind of put in a few systems that if anything is to happen, everyone wants to go after them, we kind of like know what to do to kind of keep them safe, because the last thing we want is for them to have any negative repercussions because of this.
Absolutely.
So I think they feel safe. You know, like, they feel comfortable with what we're showing and what we put out. And I think also the fact that, like, there's nothing in here that anyone locally isn't aware of brings a lot of peace to them. You know, like, at the beginning, I was like, how are you going to feel about a show? Like, I was like, how will the Rangers feel about me hanging out with you and then going and hanging out with them? And they're like, well, why would that be an issue? We hang out with the Rangers too. You know, it's like, we all hang out together. Like, so yeah, that it was a little bit of that, like, kind of outsider preconceived notions trickling into perspective. And then once I realized the complexities, it was not as big an issue as I thought it would be.
So, I mean, that little anecdote you just told is certainly, like, very illustrative of that idea of breaking down these, like, preconceived notions of, like, what this really looks like on the ground. Despite that, right? Despite that, you know, there's not really any issue between you, like, going from one side to the other. I would imagine that you spent a lot of time building up trust, you know, of these, like, two particular main characters and you know, and the sort of supporting characters that were around them. But I mean, when you encounter, like, you know, other people that they're interacting with, other members of, like, the Ranger team, I mean, how did you deal with that? Like, being the guy with the camera in those types of situations? Did some of these other people ever have, like, a negative reaction to you?
Oh,
like,
yes. I mean, I remember in the first year, really towards the end of the first year when I was there, which is when I was, like, really starting to shoot, like, there'd be times where, like, X and Asan and Lucas, like, had full trust, they were in full support of what we're doing, but, like, the community at large didn't. And, like, I'd go into situations and people would throw rocks at me. I mean, in Kenya, there's a belief that when your photograph is taken, it's sucking your soul, that a piece of your soul is taken from you when you're photographed. So culturally, like, there's a lot of reasons why people would not want me and a camera there. And so there was a point, I remember, where X was like, let's put the camera down. I just want to spend the next 2 weeks meeting with all of the village elders and anyone in the community that has questions on what we're doing. And we literally held an event where people could come and just, like, talk to us, ask us questions and hear about why we were doing this. And so that, like, that was huge. That was a huge thing, because when that isn't done, and when there's not open communications between the community and the filmmakers, it's just a ton of rumors that get spread, you know, a ton of rumors get spread around. And in a small community like this, they move fast. And so that was really important to, like, kind of build relationships with people that weren't necessarily in the film, but were like important for the community at large. So they understood what we were doing and why. And so that went a long way. But yeah, there was definitely time. I mean, even with the characters, there'd be times with the characters where like they would look to me as a source of money. Like they'd want me to help. You know, I remember one time Asan's son fell and broke his arm and they wanted me to like pay for the hospital bill. And it was this like really tricky line of like, I can't give you all money. Because then it's like I'm essentially funding the activities you're doing. And when it's this sensitive, like it jeopardizes the whole thing. And so I was really clear with them early on and stuck to it, where it's like money's not going to be transferred between us. But I did find other ways to kind of like equalize the relationship through teaching English lessons, through teaching them how to type, through lots of cooking, did a ton of babysitting. But in those moments where I wouldn't give them money when they would really want it, it hurt the relationship. They'd be like, if you're not willing to buy us food right now, you don't care about us.
Right.
You know, it'd be a, you don't care about us. And so we're done. We're quitting. And every time they quit the project, every time they're like, we don't like you anymore. We're done. If you cared about us, you'd pay for these things. And it would be, you know, I'd be there in Kenya just waiting weeks, you know, at one point, like 3-4 weeks would go by, no contact. And I just wait. But eventually we'd always get back together and we'd always like talk it out and figure it out and kind of find common ground and get on the same page. But yeah, that process of like coming from a different place financially and having all the privilege, as many outsiders do, and then to become a part of their lives, but to not interfere, to not help financially was so heartbreaking and painful and hard. But it was also important to make sure that their motivations were not financial. I wanted to make sure that they wanted this to be made and they were giving us access because they believed that people should see what's going on and see the reality. And so we stuck true to it. And it slowed down the process a lot at times. It really delayed things. But I think I don't think there was any other way we could have done it. And I will also say that like once we were finished with the film and when everything was done, we asked all the wives of the main characters, like, you know, what can we do to kind of give back? What would be most helpful? And they told us, if you can set up a fund to get our kids through school, that would be the most meaningful thing. They all would say, like, you know, for us, it's too late. You know, it's too late for us to go back to school. It's too late for us to try to like find a new or different life. But our kids still have hope. So set up a fund for them. So we've set up a fund to get all their kids all the way through college, which they're really, really thankful for. And I'm really happy we were able to do that.
Wow, that's awesome. And is there a way, I mean, have you set up a way for...
We haven't set anything up publicly. Okay. There have been a lot of people that have reached out, like individuals who have reached out privately being like, we want to help out, like, what can we do? And so we always like connect them.
Sure. Sure. Gotcha. Well, yeah, I mean, it's really powerful, amazing story, super fascinating to hear all the sort of behind the scenes stuff about how you were able to accomplish this. You've been finished with this film for about a year now, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, do you have a new project in the works? What's next for you?
I'm working on three films right now. One film is about a robot in Hong Kong named Sophia.
All right.
And another film is about a spiritual teacher in Costa Rica named Teal Swan. And then the third film is about teenagers in Arizona and what happens when families feel like their kids don't fit into society.
All right. So you're staying busy.
Yes, staying busy. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, yeah, that's I can't think of anything else to ask you. I mean, unless there's like anything that you think is important that we haven't touched on.
No, I feel like that was great. I feel like we covered a lot of the bases. And if you have any other questions or something else comes up, don't hesitate to reach out. I'm around.
Excellent. Well, thanks again for taking the time. Yeah, really awesome to hear about the sort of stories behind the story in this. And congratulations, man. Really super impressed with the film. Really, honestly, blew me away.
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate it. And thanks for having us on the show.
Yeah, you bet.
See ya.
You've been listening to the Eyes on Conservation podcast. I'm Gregory Haddock, editor of today's show. Special thanks to When Lions Become Lambs director John Casby for making time to visit with us today. For more information about the film, please visit www.winlambs.com. Music in today's show via the Free Music Archive through Creative Commons licensing. Gradual Sunrise by David Hillowitz and Siesta by Jazar. And if you haven't made a pledge to our show, please head over to our patreon.com/wildlandscollective page. And lastly, be sure to send us a voicemail to info@wildlensinc.org. Email info@wildlensinc.org. We really, really want to hear from you. I'm Gregory Haddock, saying stay safe, stay mean, stay a lean, green fighting machine. Till next time, see ya.